Welcome to Happy Hour with lawyer and TV personality Jonna Spilbor and author and inspirational speaker Carol Pesci. Happy Hour comes your way every Sunday morning at this time with life advice, real conversations, and awesome interviews with self-help heavy hitters, best-selling authors, celebrities, and more. Would you like to maybe live better, stress less, and laugh more? Then you've come to the right place.
The following is a paid program, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent the opinions of the management of this station or Hamel Broadcasting. Good morning and welcome back. This is Happy Hour with Jonna Spilbor, with Carol Pesci, with some guy that introduces Jonna Spilbor and Carol Pesci and then tags along for the ride. And we've got ourselves another fantastic show today, and we are going to be talking to a Cassidy Krug, is how you think it should be pronounced or may be pronounced there, Carol?
I'm quite sure that's accurate, Frankenberry.
Okay.
Yes. So Cassidy Krug is a former U.S. Olympian, and she has just written a book on navigating change. It is called Resurface, A Guide to Navigating Life's Biggest Transitions. And a beautiful writer. Amazing to like go from being a trained diving Olympian and also have this ability to write. I'm absolutely loving her book and looking forward to talking with her in our second segment.
All right. That sounds fantastic. Now, the only reason I was mentioning the last name is because I was kind of hoping it was Krug, because it sounds like an alien species. You know, like in some sort of sci-fi novel. You know, we're getting invaded by the Krugs. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
What were those crazy characters from The Land of the Lost? God, I'm dating myself.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes. Sleestax.
Yes.
I worked in a bar years and years ago at West Virginia University, in a very college bar, Cajun restaurant during the day, evening, and then an alternative music bar at night. Our college radio station, we supplied all the music. And our basement downstairs, where all the kegs were and where you changed the sodas and that kind of thing, where we kept the ice, it was a world of hell. And you never wanted to go down into the basement ever, but we eventually just called it the Land of the Lost. So we had drinks that were Sleestax. We had a drink that was a Chaka.
That's funny.
You remember their best friend was the Chaka. Huh. A bunch of our drinks upstairs all had Land of the Lost names.
That's fun.
That's very cute. My association with the name Krug is that it is also a brand of champagne, very expensive champagne. And I wonder if she is related to the vintner or whatever you would call it.
We can ask her.
Hey, you related to the champagner who makes Krug?
Yeah.
Because I like that. It's all bubbly. You know what it does? Makes my nose tickle.
Those bubbles get up in there.
They do. They do it before you know it.
You too.
My nose belches. How weird is that?
Oh, my God, that's disgusting. Don't ever talk about a bodily function coming out of your nose, Frankenberry.
All right. We will tell Cassidy none of this.
Yeah, I hope she doesn't come back and listen to this part.
So before we got started today, Carol and Jonna both mentioned that they were a little sleep deprived. So Carol, you can tell us a little bit why you're sleep deprived. And then Jonna, you can do the same, because I think, well, with Jonna, we know it probably involves cats.
Well, John is a little bit more interesting because it's an ongoing saga, and we know that we have listeners who tune in just to hear more about the cat saga. Mine's just my little pup was sick in the night, and
And
she's aging and gets up quite early every morning. So as the week progresses, I get a little sleepy, but that's okay.
Understood.
Does she sleep in your bed?
Yeah.
Oh, Jonna. Hello.
Okay.
Ah, stupid.
Do any of the cats sleep in your bed?
You always say that you ask the stupid question of the guests. And I'm just going to tell you right now, you just asked a stupid question of me. All right? Just own that.
Well, at least I'm consistent.
Oh, that's a good point.
Poor little Gingy. It's hard. Look, we've all been there, done that. When your animals get older, they require a little more of our attention, not that we mind giving it.
Not at all. I'll take whatever she needs over not having, you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
It's all good. It's all good. Not complaining. We got her.
It is all good.
Why are you, so Jonna Spilbor, why are you sleep deprived?
Yeah, is there something about additional cats?
Well, first, I also want to mention, because maybe later on in the show we can talk about, I just have some really exciting things going on, but the reason I'm sleep deprived is not one of them. The reason I am sleep deprived is because I have acquired, after a much needed kind of hiatus from cat catching, I think I've had a little break. I've lost track of what the time span is between the last cat I captured, which would be Tiny, and the not one, but two new feral cats I captured last weekend. It was a nice little respite. Mama had a nice little vacation from it, but guess what happened? Oh, yeah, of course. I spent all of last weekend deciding that I was going to capture a little kitten that, did you know this? Here's a little sidebar. Frank Bear, you might know this because you're a cat daddy. Do you know, number one, it is very rare for cats to give birth to a single kitten, though not impossible. And when that happens, that single kitten is called a singleton. Were you aware?
I did not know that, but that is fairly close to simpleton, and I know what that is.
Yep, that's where I went to because we are one.
Yes, exactly.
We are a collective one. Yes. So what's been happening is so Tiny, which is the last feral I captured, was one of six in the latest litter of cats that have been brought to my house. So he was one of six, and I only got him, and the other five have just been living their best life wherever they have been living them. Sometimes they come by, sometimes they don't. But there was one in particular who ended up getting, can I say knocked up? Can I say that? It's a family show, but is it okay? She ended up getting pregnant, and she was coming by every day while she was pregnant. And then, right around Memorial Day weekend, she disappeared for a couple of days. I've seen this movie before. She returned a few days later, visibly unpregnant. So there you have it. She must have given birth in that time. So, and as they do, cats take about at least a month, sometimes longer, before they bring their little ones up, you know, to introduce them to this sucker who's been feeding the mother cat for all this time.
Can I
And
pause you for a second?
please,
I find this
and
Frankenberry, join me in the kitchen, please.
Okay, yes, John, just wait for us there.
we'll be right back.
All right.
Isn't it funny how she, she speaks on national television as an authority on the law, crime, other legal matters, and just listen to her speaking as a pro, knowing everything about feral cats and the timeline, everything. It's just.
I know, and it's something that we would never even have thought was a remote possibility a
No.
couple of years ago.
No. Okay.
No.
All right, we're done. We're back. Continue.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, so fast forward a couple of weeks ago, this formerly pregnant cat, who is Tiny's sibling, brought up a little kitten. Now, this kitten has one of the ugliest faces I've ever seen.
Okay,
Not
now again,
possible.
I think we've already been there, but you're just telling yourself it's an ugly face, but keep
Oh,
going.
Frankenberry, if it works for her, let's let her.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. Whatever. Yeah.
And for that reason, I'm like, oh no, nobody's ever gonna love this kitten, right? Like the face is so, I call her Faccia Brutta. That's Italian for funny face. So, but actually her name is Ziggy. So Ziggy
Oh,
is funny face. Here's what happens. When you get him to the vet goes, oh, and what is this one's name? And you can't
N number 10.
ugly face. I call her ugly face in Italian. Faccia Brutta, that's her name. I don't know how to spell it. It's Italian.
Start numbering them, please.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Number 12. So number 12 has eyes that are so close together, they're practically one big eye. I should
Oh.
Cyclops. Anyhow, so I figured I got to do something because she's just too ugly to love. Long story short, I've been putting traps out and traps out and traps out. And last weekend, last Saturday at night, at about 9 o'clock at night, she goes into the trap. Now,
How do you know this?
how do I know she goes into, because I'm sitting there watching her go into the trap.
Okay.
Yeah, no, you can't leave at my house, you cannot leave traps unmanned, which is why it makes the process harder, because the raccoons and other crap and skunks and I just don't want to deal with that. Could you imagine me like out on my deck in my DJs trying to let a skunk out of a trap in the
Oh,
middle
you'd
of
be
the night.
calling me.
Yeah,
Oh,
exactly.
it'd be terrible. It'd be terrible. So
Terrible.
I'm watching the whole thing unfold, and the little one goes into the trap, and I'm mildly happy about that because that's step one in the process accomplished. So I bring the little one into the house, and then that's the whole thing. You got to put it into a playpen, blah, blah, blah. Well, that goes okay. 4 hours later. So what would that be? I know, 1 o'clock in the morning.
Are you still watching at this point, or do you have like a motion sensor?
So no, so I don't need a motion sensor. I just need ears because at 1 o'clock in the morning,
Blink.
the little one is in a playpen. I transferred her from, and by the way, every single time I capture a feral kitten, 100% of the time, I have incorrectly guessed the sex, and my record is completely intact because I thought this little guy was a boy. I kept calling him little boy, little boy, little boy. Turns out little girl. But anyway, I digress. So I get Ziggy into, I mean, 12, into the playpen, get her situated. Now she's, newly separated from her mother. And keep in mind, she's a singleton. So maybe, that's going to add a little bit of stress to the situation.
Did you put the playpen in the room with the other? Oh, I'm losing track. Eight.
Sorry for that bad reception. I'm going to forget you asked that question. The answer, however, is the singleton had to stay downstairs.
Okay.
Couple of reasons. You can't introduce them to other cats until you get them checked out, blah, blah, blah. Also,
All right.
they cry all night. Not good for my under eye circles. So I get her situated. That's all well and good. She's downstairs, happy, water, food, everything she needs, blah. 1 o'clock in the morning. I wake up because from the outside of my house, with all my windows closed,
Oh no.
I can hear the mother cat screaming, screaming and
Oh, poor
meowing and
baby.
meowing and screaming.
Oh.
Right. So now I'm like, oh, what am I gonna do? I get up. I go downstairs because it was so bad, you guys. I honestly thought that like a neighbor might, I don't know, do something, get mad at me, call the police, try to hurt the, I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. I was delirious. So I go downstairs. I open the sliding glass door. The mother cat is there, screaming her head off. She walks into my house.
Oh
I shut the door.
my God. Okay, good for you.
If you've ever done that, anybody within the sound of our voice who's ever locked a feral cat in their house without a crate knows that anything breakable you have on a jumpable surface, you might as well just kiss it goodbye. Because for the next 15 minutes, you and that cat are going to be fisticuffs.
Did you at least point out her kitten to her?
She saw it, but she's a little selfish. This is her first litter, and she was like, oh, wait a minute. You got me. Snap. Oh, snap. I don't like it. So I got her to calm down enough to pay attention to the kitten, but she wouldn't also go in the playpen. So I've had a feral cat free-ranging her way
No.
for a week
No.
in
Nice.
my house.
That's adventure.
Yes, I have. Now here's the weird part. Here's
That
that's right. The audience right now is going, holy cow, she's gotten to the point where that's not weird.
I know, right?
What's your plan, Stan?
Well, I do have a sort of plan. So I got the little one to the vet who's too young for the whole barrage of shots, but got a couple of them, got checked out. My plan is now I've got to somehow get the mother cat, whose name is Juno, into a carrier and sedated and get to a vet so that she can be, shots and fixed, right? This whole
Right.
point is like she's got to
Oh
be fixed.
my
If I'm not going
God.
to fix her, what's the point in putting up with this? So she has been the most relaxed, chill cat that I think I have had, including the ones that I have been nurturing for the last 2 weeks. She, within a day, lounging, relaxing, going in, I moved the kitten into my little breakfast nook, put a gate up. She jumps over the gate, lets the kitten play, feed, jumps out of that area, goes, lays under the couch, occasionally will meow. She kind of likes the poker table. She's eating, she's doing all cat things as if inside was her first environment, and it was not. So, kind of strange.
Where is she pooping and other stuff?
Okay, good question. Glad you asked that. I'm glad you asked. The one.
I'm assuming you are going to come to the litter box part, right?
Well, so the kitten's doing great with the litter box. Absolutely fantastic. And Juno, the mother, it definitely is doing number one in the litter box. Number two, not so much.
Think number two is actually easier to clean up, though.
Yes, I've learned that because I've had to clean it up 3 times. So I don't really know what's going on, but
Unbelievable.
I chat GPT the situation, and I'm doing all the things to make sure that she gets used to doing that in the litter box. I think at this point it is now working, but I also think sometimes the universe likes to have a good laugh at my expense, and it did.
Well, I have to tell you one thing there, John. When years ago, when I was bringing slowly but surely bringing Grayson into the apartment, you know, I told you guys the whole story. He was astray, and you know, neighbors had been feeding him. They left, and I would feed him every day outside. But eventually, when the weather got bad, I bought a cage and I put it at the top of my steps in my apartment. He'd sleep at night. Bella could see who he was, but I still hadn't had a chance to get him to the vet because I didn't have the money. And then I'd let him out during the day. But eventually, once he got the okay from the vet, and I got rid of the cage, and I let him free reign the apartment. He and Bella got to know each other. That dude never, ever even approached the front door. He was like, "This is heaven. I'm all good. I got windows. This dude buys things I can lay in a window that has what he calls carpet on them. This place is heaven. I'm good." So it does happen.
So, how are you going to catch Juno and get Juno to get fixed?
So I think because she's acclimating, I will be able to entice her either into a comfortable carrier or use the trap inside
Right, inside. Yep, okay.
and get her in there, and then take it from there. But guys, I'm serious about this. Here's my real problem. I need them to have a home that's not mine. And the longer they are inside my home with me, the harder that is going to be for me to do.
And your plan on that is?
Don't you have a cousin that you can drop them on a doorstep and run away again?
Oh,
Or a Frankenberry?
I don't know about that. There's already five in my house.
My cousin, who I was planning to ding dong dash the trap with, I was going to ding dong dash.
Okay, and?
And I said to her, "Hey, you know, could you just for a couple weeks until I get Juno to the vet, can you foster 12, whose name is Ziggy?" She said, and I quote, "Not at this time."
Now, well, let me ask you a quick question, though.
Not at this time.
Wouldn't you consider like trying to pair mom and the kitten for the adoption?
I think they should go as a pair.
Oh yes, I would think so too. And
Because here's the thing, you guys, there are so many cats in these shelters that it's really hard to adopt cat. There's too many cats, not enough people.
there's too many animals, period. Dogs and cats. Oh, my friend. All right, so all joking aside, how many are upstairs in the bedroom? Is it eight? Nine. It's nine, Frankenberry.
Well,
Is it nine?
she has reached the number 12 with the new one, so there's got to be a
You
9,
have
10, and
10
11.
upstairs in the bathroom? I mean, in the bedroom?
No, I do
How
not have
many?
10.
Nine.
Yeah, exactly.
How many?
I am not telling you on the air. I will tell you off the air.
You need to build a catio. We talked about it a long time ago. You need to have like a little outdoor access, and then they can go outside but be contained.
And there are people that do that for a living, some very cool ones, as a matter of fact.
And like have little areas where they could look, duck down and hide, but then they'll resurface.
I
Ah, there we go. It's time to pop. It's
was
time to pop some Krug champagne.
Oh, yes.
Whoa.
Oh, that was a beauty.
That was very good.
Okay. Coming up after the break, we will be speaking with Cassidy Krug. She's a former U.S. Olympian, and she's recently written a book called Resurface: A Guide to Navigating Life's Biggest Transitions. And I'm loving her book.
All right. That is what's on the way. Jonas Billboard, Carol Pesci, this fella, and we will be right back with our guest. Champagne all around.
All right.
Sunday mornings with 92.9 WBPM means you'll laugh more and stress less. Now here's more Happy Hour with Jonna and Carol.
And welcome back again, everyone, to Happy Hour. It's Jonna Spillboard. It's Carol Pesci. It's this fella that they let him tag along, and that's so nice of them. And it's time now to get to our guest for today, and Carol is going to introduce us to Cassidy and tell us why Cassidy is here.
Yes, we have on the line with us Cassidy Krug. She's an Olympian, author, and innovation strategist based in Los Angeles, California. A 10-time national champion, she represented Team USA in the 3-meter springboard in the 2012 London Olympics, finishing seventh. And she's going to tell us about that because that's a key element to her writing the book she's here to talk about. After retiring from competitive diving, Cassidy dove headfirst into a career in brand and innovation strategy. Her debut book, Resurface: A Guide to Navigating Life's Biggest Transitions, hit shelves in June of this year and is a personal and practical roadmap for anyone facing change. When not at her desk, you can find her negotiating with her 2-year-old. Good luck with that. And teaching trampoline classes at the Santa Monica Trapeze School. Cassidy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, so I do want to get into the backstory of your book, what made you want to write this. But first, I just have completely fascinated. Fascinating, selfish question to ask you about becoming an Olympian. So from a viewer's standpoint, it's always moving and fascinating. What is it like participating in the opening and closing ceremonies?
Oh my gosh. It felt almost like being born. It was like, so in 2012, the opening ceremony, the big stadium where the opening ceremonies were, was I think about a mile from the athlete village. And so we're walking while the show part of the ceremonies is happening. We're walking toward the stadium and it's dark. And then we get into the bottom of the stadium and it's very dark. And there's just all these athletes and the anticipation is palpable. And then we head to a light. And
Oh my gosh.
there's light and there's noise and it's getting closer and closer and closer. And then all of a sudden you're out in it. And I remember confetti and music and the stadium was full from the bottom to the top and everyone is cheering and you're like, I'm here. I'm at the Olympics now. And I'm getting chills just talking about it again. It's such a strong memory for me.
Wow. And then the closing ceremony is similar.
Yeah. The closing ceremony is similar. It's a little bit different because you've already done your work, you know, the thing that you've been, the thing you've been anticipating maybe your whole life. But it's still, again, it feels like such a celebration. I think that the Spice Girls performed at ours, which was huge.
Oh, fun.
I also remember they played Hey Jude and the camera happened to be on us, the diving team, while that was happening. And we're sitting there and we're singing and we're like, oh, man, this is amazing. And then a couple moments later, we're like, wow, this song keeps going on for a long time.
Well, it is Hey Jude.
Yeah. Awesome. Oh, I can only imagine because it's moving as because you've been obsessed with it. Your parents were divers and involved in the Olympics since you were very young. So you've always been an avid viewer yourself. So it's interesting to get a firsthand take from someone who's been there. Okay, so you're here today. Congratulations to talk about your book, Resurface. I mentioned to you off air, I want to tell our audience, you've been listening to our show for a while. You know, John and I are both avid readers, maybe obsessive readers of self-improvement. I've read a ton of books. This book is so beautifully written. It has such helpful insight, your story, stories of others for any. And look, you're not going to get through life without navigating change. So this is a beautiful, beautifully written guide to help people do that. But let's back up for a second. And I would love to know, tell us the backstory. I kind of hinted when I was reading your bio that you finishing seventh at the 2012 Olympics was a turning point and ultimately led to writing this book. What's the backstory? Tell us the backstory, why it was important for you to write this book.
Absolutely. So yes, once upon a time, I went to the Olympics. It was in 2012. I was 27 years old and had been diving almost my whole life. My parents are both diving coaches. And I after trying three times to qualify for the Olympic team, I made it to London and I got to compete there. It was the absolute peak of my career. And then the day after that, I retired and diving was over. That was a pretty enormous transition at the time. I remember being full of, you know, both excitement and a feeling of freedom and also, you know, terror. Like, what the heck am I going to do next? Eventually I moved on, but over the course of the next however many years, I kept feeling like I had sort of transitioned on from diving. I had moved forward. I went to New York. I got a job in advertising. I started working up the career ladder. But I kept thinking about that transition. Like anytime, you know, work wasn't going well, I would think back to diving. And I came to a point where I was feeling a little bit burned out and I just kept thinking, like, why am I still thinking about diving? You know, why am I still wondering if I made the right decision, if I peaked? And that sort of fixation on that particular transition led me to start interviewing other people I could find about their biggest turning points. At first, it was just Olympic athletes, and I was really looking to see if anyone else felt like I did. I was looking to see if anyone could give me a pep talk. I was looking to see if anyone could commiserate with this sort of all this emotion that I still felt around my sport. And then as I was having those Olympian conversations, I started to realize that they were very similar to conversations I was having with people in other parts of my life. Like my dad had just retired and he was sitting on the couch trying to figure out what to do next. And it felt really similar to those transition conversations I was having with Olympians. A friend of mine was facing serious health problems. She was in remission from cancer, but she wasn't, you know, bouncing back the way that she had hoped to. And that felt like it was similar too. So that's how this book was born. I started reaching out to people from all walks of life who had experienced really big transitions in their lives to learn from them and to compare notes and to hear their stories. And that is where this book came from.
Cassidy, go ahead, Shana.
What did you do, and I guess maybe without giving too much away, what did you discover about yourself? So you're 27 years old and you basically retire from a sport that you love, then couldn't stop, you know, thinking about it. What did you discover? What was the why behind that?
Yeah, first of all, you know, big transitions are the turning points that kind of set our lives in the directions they end up going. Like they are the turning points that make us who they are. I think I had a misconception, which is that, you know, I was a diver, I retired from diving, and you move on. And I think I tried to move on so quickly without really recognizing that there was grief there. And also that, like, this, the diving, the Olympics, like training had been a big part of my life. Like for me, I thought I was just going to roll all of the passion and the purpose and the energy and the time into my work career and just sort of move forward. And I think that's number one, very hard to do. I think number two, just the concept of trying to replace something that you loved with something totally different kind of sets you up for too high of expectations and kind of sets you up for it not to work. Number three, I had to both recognize that diving and training for the Olympics was a huge part of me, and also recognize that it kind of shaped moving forward and kind of also embrace and feel gratitude for the life that I ended up with afterwards.
Yeah. So that kind of transition. So I guess the book will help people figure out how you can embrace the past as you transition into something in the future. And not to make light of this at all, but I was thinking like what you did. And this is, again, I'm really good at saying the stupid things on this show, but it's like, it's like when you have a beloved dog and, you know, the dog dies of old age and then you have to replace it with another dog. But in your case, you like replaced a dog with a goldfish, like, and you had to figure out how to embrace that instead.
That is quite an analogy, my friend.
I think it works. I totally, you know, I was expecting the goldfish to make me feel as proud and as certain as this sport I had been doing since I was like a couple years old. You know, I was expecting the goldfish to carry all this weight. And at the same time, like, I wasn't really appreciating the goldfish for being gold. You know, I was, so yeah, I think it's actually a really good analogy.
Only Jana. Cassidy, early on in your book, you educate us that there's actually four different categories of types of change we experience. Can you touch on those?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is important because transitions are so big and kind of hard to wrap your mind around. And I think these four really help to kind of ground it. So there are anticipated transitions. Those are the ones we see coming, like a college graduation or a retirement that we've been looking forward to from years away. There are unanticipated transitions. Those are the ones we don't see coming, like, you know, a terrible, you know, a diagnosis or an injury or on the plus side, winning the lottery. I think those are the two things we usually think of when we think of transitions, but there's actually two more categories that I think are really helpful to think about. One of those is a sleeper transition. Those are ones that we may experience and may not even recognize until years later. Like, I have a 2.5-year-old, and I sometimes think, you know, at some point I'm going to kind of hold her in my arms for the last time. You know, at some point she's going to be a teenager and I'm not going to be able to like hold her up anymore. And what is that going to mean? And how is that, and all of the transitions I'm going to face as a parent? You just don't necessarily recognize that you're moving on until years after it's happened. And then the final one is a non-event. And these are things that we plan for and hope for. We build our dreams around them, and then they don't happen. So, for example, if you really want kids and you're trying and trying and you picture your life as a parent and then you don't end up being able to have kids, that's a non-event. And that is a really impactful, or that can be a really impactful transition as well.
And I think it's so helpful, because just those four categories takes something massive and kind of organizes it. Sometimes when we name our monster, right, it becomes easier to understand and cope with. So, and I think we're also, we judge ourselves too harshly, don't give ourselves permission to grieve or be sad or, you know, and in your book, you're helping us understand, yeah, there's four different ways. So maybe something major, catastrophic did or did not happen, but there's still different ways that we face these things that are difficult, and there's grieving in all of them.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think for me that was really hard, actually. I didn't think I was allowed to grieve diving because I had made the choice to move forward from it. Like, I was the one that chose to retire. So why am I feeling sad about this? And let's just shove those feelings away. But a transition, it inevitably involves leaving behind something that mattered to you. And even if you're leaving it for something else that matters to you, there's still some grieving, and there's still a need to celebrate that past and recognize and honor what you're leaving.
And Cassidy, can you help us understand, I forget the exact line in your book, but the difference between change and transitioning?
Yeah. So there is an anthropologist named, oh my God, I just based on the name, but there's an anthropologist, and he says change is something that happens to you. Transition is how you choose to react to that change. And I actually have an addendum. I believe there's a third step, and I believe the third step is interpretation. Interpretation is how you tell your story of that transition to yourself and to the rest of the world. And that's something that you can do, you know, when you're anticipating a big change. It's how you tell the story of what you expect to happen when you're in the middle of it. And even years later, you can look back and you can say, oh, you know, with perspective, this is how I see that change and how it happened to me. And I think it's so important to get that third step, because that's really, you know, how we form our own identities, how we form our perception of ourselves and what we're capable of in the future.
I want to add something here, John. I'm sorry. I know you have some of this. This is right on point. Reading from your book on interpretation, you said, "I may have messed up my last dive, but while doing so, I proved that I could master the shaky dread of competition, embrace my adrenaline, and I had fun doing it." Interpretation isn't about blacking out the bits I don't want to remember. It's about highlighting the bits I do. Beautiful. Powerful.
Yeah. I was never a good competitor. I had teammates who would go to practice and kind of be sort of mediocre, and then they'd get into the competition and somehow they'd kick into fourth gear and they would kill it. They'd be so good. I was kind of the opposite. I felt like I had to be so much better. I had to be better than everybody else in order to achieve sort of like baseline in competition. The idea of standing on the end of the diving board and performing something that mattered so much would make me shaky and sweaty and hyper-focused. And I really, over the course of my career, and I was on the national team for, I think, 9 years, I really worked to both embrace those butterflies and learn to sort of control my physical reaction to being on the end of the board. And by the Olympics, it worked. You know, every dive I did at the Olympic trials and the Olympics, which were the two biggest meets of my life, every dive I did, except for the last one, were among the best of my career. And I truly, like, I had always dreaded competition and I truly enjoyed it. And then, of course, the last dive came around. I was in the running for third, which was, you know, loads better than I had ever done at an international competition before. And I remember standing on the board and being just so excited to show people what I could do in that dive. And I had a little brain fart, I guess. And I underperformed. I did that dive worse than I normally do. And I came up and I got seventh. And so a story like that, I could see as a failure. And I remember walking after the competition, you go through the mix zone and you talk to reporters, and every one of them was trying to make me cry. You know, they saw that last dive and they saw, you know, the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. And even in that moment, I was like, I can choose to interpret this as a competition in which I beat my fear. I loved competing. I rose to the occasion, and just this one blip kept it from being on the medal stand. But it really was like you could look at it both ways. And I really worked to look at it the way that made me feel like I had accomplished something and that recognized what I had accomplished.
As you should. One of the things, I know that we're running out of time here, but I wanted to a couple of points ago. I think it's important, and I think your book will help people too, get past when you are making a pivot, when you are making a transition like you did. You must have had a moment or more where you second guessed your decision, right? You second guessed your decision to move on, to start your life and your career. And I think everybody, 100% of people probably have at least a moment of that, if not longer, when they're also transitioning into something else. And that's probably the faster you can get through the second guessing, I think the better everybody is. And that's not easy to do.
No, and I think that's true. I also think that we should all give ourselves a lot of grace when we're in the middle of a big transition. Like, you're probably going from something, whether that's, you know, a passion like diving, whether that's a career, whether that's a relationship, whether that's a place where you really knew what you were about, what you were doing each day, you know, what your habits were, how you navigated the world. And then some change happens and all of a sudden you don't anymore. And that murk is a scary feeling. And there are certainly ways to help yourself get through it, but also you can't skip it. Like, you are going to have times when you feel uncertain, times when you feel maybe regret, times when you're not sure if you've made the right decision. And just, I think, to know that everybody feels those things, and that is a side effect of change, which is what life's all about. I think that's important.
I agree.
Cassidy, you're so inspiring. I can't wait to finish your book. And I feel like it would also make a great gift for someone you care about who's going through a major life change. Again, beautifully, beautifully written, personal stories. You're not a psychologist, but you introduced psychology into the book of what advice you would get for some things you can do to help yourself process and interpret the change that you're going through. We're wrapping up here with Cassidy Krug, a former U.S. Olympian. She's the author of Resurface, a guide to navigating life's biggest transitions. Cassidy, if people wanted to learn more about you, buy your book, so on, where would they go to do that?
You can buy your book anywhere books are sold, particularly at your local bookstore. I recorded the audiobook myself, so if that's your
Oh,
thing,
fun.
and you want to listen to me reading it myself, you can do that. And you can keep up to date on Instagram at Cassidy Krug.
And
We have one question.
Cassidy, I have one question. When you were walking through the mix, and like you said, all those reporters, all those meanies were trying to make you cry, did you get any satisfaction and punch any of them in the throat?
I wish that would have been a totally different story. I'm not sure if I needed those headlines either.
That would have been the book she wrote from jail, Frankenberry.
Hey, I'm just curious, okay?
But wait, okay, one last question, Cassidy, before we let you go. We have to know if you're related to the Champagne Krugs, because there is a champagne that bears your surname and it's very expensive.
I do know this. I don't believe I'm related, although at times I've wanted to go knock on their door and claim to be a long lost cousin or something like that. But unfortunately, I don't think I'm related.
And Cassidy, I'm with you. I have thought to myself, I'd like to go knock on the door of General Mills and say, listen, can I get a couple of bucks for this Frankenberry thing, please? For a lifetime of bad jokes. But yeah, that wouldn't happen either. So, but anyway, listen, Cassidy, thank you so much for joining us today. Fantastic story. I
Yes.
really enjoyed that. And we are not done yet. Oh, by the way, Cassidy, trapeze school, really? That's a thing?
It is. Yeah, they are all over the place.
Holy cow.
And adults, kids, everyone can learn, and it's very safe. You're in a harness the whole time. And if you have any interest in doing it, I would say look up your local trapeze school and give it a try, because it's a thrill that you don't necessarily get in your normal life.
Oh, well, there you go. That's your next pivot, man, running off to the circus. All right. We've got more Happy Hour on the way here with Jonas Spilbore and Carol Fesci. Thanks again to Cassidy Krug for joining us. And we'll be right back with segment number three. So please stick around.
Sunday mornings with 92.9 WBPM means you'll laugh more and stress less. Now here's more Happy Hour with Jonna and Carol.
And welcome back one more time to Happy Hour. Jonna Spilbore, Carol Pesci. Hello, ladies.
Hello, Frankenberry.
Which one of you just said hello?
Carol.
Oh, that was Carol. Nicely done, Carol. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that. Hello. No, hello.
Hello. I was a little bit mimicking how you. Oh, there goes one of my earbuds. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Yes. But hey, Cassidy Krug, she was great. And it was, and wow, talk about, you know what, that's, it was a nice conversation because we got a little bit of the inside view. And Carol, that was a fantastic question to start the interview.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome very much. But just to get a little bit of an inside picture of what it's like to be an Olympian at, you know, that opening ceremony and, you know, and what she told about the, you know, the fact that she was in line for the bronze and she just had that one brain fart. She had that one bad dive, you know?
Yeah. Yep. And in the book, she said she came up out of the water and looked over at her coach, and he just had his head in his hands. But yeah, and so the helpful knowledge of the different ways we can go through change and transition, some of the key steps to processing that, because how many people, she's bright, cheerful, she's written a fantastic book, could live almost their entire lives going for a certain goal, making a mistake at the last moment, and still finding a way to hang on to the best parts of that experience and not for the rest of your life beat yourself up for that one small mistake. Now, there was consequences for her for making that mistake, but what an inspiration of how the perspective she has chosen and the interpretation of what she experienced. It's amazing.
And everybody can learn a lesson from that, because let's be real. We might not all make it to the Olympics, obviously, and have something like that happen where we don't realize our dream. But these kinds of things, disappointments, lost opportunity, loss in general, happen all the damn time, right? Mm-hmm. In different contexts. And you've got to learn how to navigate your way out of it. Or if she said, you know, the title of her book is Resurface, or what? The alternative is an unhappy life. And nobody wants that, obviously.
Right.
Not always easy, though. You know, you
nope.
lose somebody you love, or, you know, you don't get that job, or you get divorced, whatever. Every day.
Right.
You could be in the face.
And we've seen many examples, you know, throughout our lives of people who don't do it the right way.
Yeah.
You know, people who do hold on to that moment, that mistake for the rest of their lives and not give themselves an opportunity to get over it and look at the best parts instead, like Carol said there. And like she said, as opposed to looking at only the worst part.
Exactly. Right. The book's fantastic. I highly recommend it. And I do need to bring something up before we wrap the show today, because when this airs, somebody will be having a birthday shortly after. So we would like to wish our favorite Jonah Spielberg a very happy birthday this week.
Oh my God. And you know what? I am so envious. I would so wish to turn 39 again and again and again.
Glorious. It's glorious, you guys. I do it over and over and over again.
That's right. That's right. And you know what?
Good at it.
Yes, exactly. And you know what? And to give you credit there, Spielberg, over the last number of years, you have at least come to a little bit, or you have admitted at least a little bit, the moving forward thing, because it used to be that you were always turning 29.
That's right, Frank.
Yes,
Mary.
Yeah.
When we started doing this show.
Yeah, you did amend that and at least go forward a bit to 39.
I did. I mean,
yeah, so sometime by around 2050, you'll be saying you're turning 49 again.
Oh, no. I think 39 is my cutoff. I don't care if I'm 39. I'm still going to say 39. I know we only have like a couple quick. I have to say something, though, along those lines, because I shamelessly need to self-promote. So I'm doing this new podcast venture that's a brainchild of Megyn Kelly. And on the very first episode, which when you're hearing our voice on the radio, the very first episode will have aired the last Wednesday. So just a few days ago. I got to encourage everybody to watch it, because in that show, she does a montage, which includes yours truly, from things that I said on the air over the last 21 years with
Wow.
21 years. And she goes way back. And I just want to say out loud, thank you, Botox, because I think I look different, but I don't look any older. And I credit that to the needle, to the botulism toxin. I appreciate you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That's all I'm going to say.
And what's the name of the show again for people who missed?
It's called MK True Crime.
Okay. And it's a YouTube show, right?
It's on the YouTube.
It's on the YouTube. Okay. And then doesn't Mama Nance have a birthday around now too?
And Mama Nance's birthday is August 14th, 2 days after mine. So shout out, Mama Nance.
Happy birthday, Mama Nance.
All right. Well, you know, it'll be a couple of weeks later, but my sister is in the same window as you all, because she will have her birthday on the 25th. So she is an August girl as well.
Bex, right?
What's
Happy
that?
Happy birthday, Bex.
Yes, yes. So, all right. Well, listen, to Cassidy Krug for joining us today, thank you so very much. And for Jonas Spillmore and for Carol Pesci and for, again, you all being so kind to let me tag along. This has been Happy Hour, and we will be back again next week, same time, same bat time, same bat channel, and we'll talk to you then. Be good.
You've been listening to Happy Hour with Jonas Spillmore and Carol Pesci. If you missed last weekend's show or want to hear it again, visit the Happy Hour page at 929WBPM.com. There's more life advice, real conversation, and another awesome interview next Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Live better, stress less, and laugh more with Happy Hour on 92.9 WBPM.